Actually, I don't work with Bearing Point. Just in full and open disclosure, I work for the Centers for Disease Control and got my master's in information and computer science from Georgia Tech, and I've been working at CDC for a little over 25 years now, so I've done a little bit of everything from programming to designing systems to architecting databases to systems administration and managing IT, and now I'm an enterprise architect, so I'm with CDC's enterprise architecture activity. And that seems like how a lot of the architects come about. They do a little of everything, and then they kind of know how everything fits together. And talking about open source today, because enterprise architects get their nose into a little bit of everything. So we've been looking at open source, how that fits into the architecture at CDC, and so I wanted to share with you a little bit about some of the things we've learned over the past couple of years about open source. This is what Brian and I will be covering today. So we'll give you a little bit of an overview, talk a little bit about the community composition for open source kinds of projects, kind of licensing that's involved when you're talking about open source software, the kinds of project governance and change control that you might need. Might be slightly different with open source projects than with other kinds of projects. And then we'll talk about one case study where we, as the Enterprise Architecture Group, developed with, along with other folks within CDC, an open source policy for being able to select open source software to actually bring into the CDC architecture and environment. Let's see, maybe I can clip this on so I'll quit making so much noise. Oops. How's that? Can you still hear me? Okay. So, what is open source? A lot of people are a little confused about it. Open source really just refers to the fact that the source code for software is open for everyone to see. But of course, that has a lot of implications and a lot of different meanings as you get down into some of the details. There's actually So typically you'll see a lot of characteristics that define what open source software is, and you can find those if you go to the Open Source Initiative at that URL up there with the Open Source Initiative at their website. They define 10 major characteristics of open source software. And the three main ones are the fact that you have free redistribution at runtime code. So basically, it's free to acquire, and it's free for you to redistribute. So the price is right. The availability of the program source code. So like I said before, the actual source code of the software is available, and everyone can look at it. And it must allow derived works. So people who look at that source code and then decide they can do a better job of it, or maybe they can add some functionality to it, they can do that. And there's some other characteristics that you can find at the Open Source Initiative, and they kind of fall along with those, but those are the three main ones. And in terms of licensing for open source, there's, I think, at least 72 different versions, but there are 72 that are certified by OSI, and as you can see, they range from A to Z, and so as an example here, there's one called the Academic Free License. And then there's one called the ZOP public license, so literally from A to Z. But they generally fall into two major categories. They're either viral or non-viral or somewhere in between the two, so it's really a spectrum. The viral kinds of licenses requires that other projects that are based upon them also be open source. And non-viral is basically you can use it for whatever you want to use it for. So you're probably aware that a lot of software that's been developed by private companies actually have open source software embedded in them, but you won't see it because once they embed it, then it becomes part of their code and it's no longer viewable. But that's allowed in those kinds of licenses. And the somewhere in between, well, there's like I say, there's a variation. So it can range anywhere in between those two. And a lot of organizations will set up their own licensing policy, as we'll talk about in a little bit, that fits their particular organization. So open source is not new. It's not a brand new thing. It's been around for a long time. And so just a little timeline in the 60s and 70s, ARPANET, RFC, was really the building blocks of the internet, came out, and that was a government project. In the 1980s, the GNU project was used extensively within Unix environments. And GNU is one of those terms people ask me, well, what does that stand for? It's not the animal, but it's actually, I think it was a self-referential acronym, which I thought was kind of strange, because it actually stands for GNU is not Unix. So you still don't know what GNU stands for, really. And in the 1990s, then we saw really a proliferation of these open source things that everyone has heard about. And Linux was one of the first really successful open source projects that was open to everyone to be able to look at the source code and actually be able to contribute to the advancement of that code. And then after that, Apache sort of followed along from the first web browser and web servers that were developed at the National Center for Supercomputing Application at University of Illinois. MySQL is an open source database based on the SQL language, relational database management system, which is still available and one of the most used open source database management systems out there. And of course, this led to a stack of open source from operating system to web server to database to programming language, and called the LAMP stack, or L-A-M-P. And we left off the P because the P actually stands for those programming languages that are open source that are used, like Perl and PHP and Python, so there's a whole list of those. So if you ever see the term LAMP or LAMP stack, LAMP software, that's what that's referring to. Those are those major open source software initiatives that are out there and that people are basing a lot of their systems on these days. We just recently celebrated the 15th anniversary of Debian Linux to give you an idea of how long some of this major stuff has been around. Apache is the most widely used web server in the world. 49 out of the top 100 websites use Apache as their web server. and MySQL database was bought recently. Who bought them, Brian? Do you know who bought them?
Sun?
Okay. So Sun just recently bought them, but it's still open source and still free. But a lot of the new business practices around open source has to do with supporting the software. So for instance, you'll see that there's a Red Hat version of Linux. Well, Red Hat, you know, they don't make their money from selling the software, but they make their money from supporting that software. And Red Hat just recently bought JBoss, which is an application server, and it's the same business model. So, and that has gone a long way to making open source a viable entity within corporate America, within large organizations that really, where the IT support folks want you to bring in software where they know there's going to be somebody out there with a contract to support that software. And so you can get software that's supported now. Almost every major open source software is supported by some big company somewhere. So, and it's not even new to the government. So it's been around a while, even back to ARPANET. So NSA has developed the Security Enhanced Linux back in 2001. And the DoD issued a memo that allowed for open source software to be brought into the DoD architecture back in 2003. Department of Homeland Security developed the Science and Technology Directorate grants that supported open source. And HHS in the National Institutes of Health, and specifically the National Cancer Institute, began developing the Cancer Biomedical Informatics Grid, which is based on open source and grid technology. and service-oriented architecture, and they began that back around 2003, 2004. So it's been going for about 4 years now, and there are a lot more examples. So Brian found these, and this is really interesting. This is the growth of open source over the last 15 years or so. So starting back in 1993. And you'll see it's a logarithmic growth curve. And for any of those who have taken biology, you recognize that this is the population growth of a population of animals that's thriving and doing quite well. I would say from this that open source as a population of things is doing quite well because it's thriving and growing logarithmically. So there must be something there and something very successful about it for it to thrive that well. And some of the reasons for that is that, there are a lot of benefits to going with open source. I mean, there's cost savings. If you're using open source software from outside your organization, the cost savings can be significant. And because you're going from paying licensing fees and support and maintenance fees to paying just the support and maintenance fees because licensing fees don't exist anymore for open source software. Increased quality, and although you'll hear some folks that are sort of rooted in the past who will argue about that, but the fact is that if for every measure that's been used to look at open source software, the quality is better than commercial software, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but probably the main reason is because the source code is open, everyone can see it. There are more eyes looking at the source code so that the quality of the code is actually better. There's a lot more people looking at it to improve the quality. And that also holds true for security. There are more people looking for security bugs in the software and finding them early and fixing them. There's also an increased community surrounding these open source. Because it is open source, you can actually invite folks from anywhere to participate in your software development. You can make it fairly open. You can make it as closed as you want to, but you can open it up to folks who normally wouldn't be working on a project with you to actually help you to test the code, to fix the code, to submit changes in the code for you. Now, there are some negatives associated with it. It's not all positive. It is a different method. They have different methods for supporting the software, like I was talking about a little bit earlier. The business model is a little different, but you can contract support for software that you get from outside your agency. If you actually building open source software yourself, then your way of supporting it, you have to think about that, and how are you going to support that if you build your own open source software. It is a culture change. The way open source software is built is very different from the way closed or standard software has been built in the past. There's a lot of issues around the way the project is managed, and we'll be hearing a lot about that and coming up in the next two presentations about how open source and project management work together. But it really is a culture change, so I'll leave that to the other folks to talk a little bit about what that is and how you might address that. And is this where I shift it over to you? Or I'm not quite then. These are just some of the key principles. It's transparency. You want to make sure that if you're developing open source that all activities are open, the source code is viewable, everyone knows what everyone else is doing. There has to be a relationship of trust involved in the group that's developing open source software, because they can vote with their feet. They don't have to stay with the project if they're volunteering their time, especially. There needs to be some discoverability, so all the output is described and made available so that people know where to find it, know where it is. And communication, that's really key. I mean, in any kind of project you do, communication is really the base of everything. But if you're developing an open source project where you've got a lot of people who may be geographically dispersed, then communication becomes extraordinarily critical. So now I'm going to switch it over to Brian, and he's going to cover a little bit of these other sections for us. Brian.
Thanks, Mike. So Mike sort of started you off with the overview. I'm going to talk about community licensing and also some of the governance changes with project management. And then Mike's going to come back and finish up with how the CDC open source policy can affect your projects, and then also concluding statements. So the idea is community. Every project has community, whether it's organized or not. But in open source, it's actually a different relationship because the community owns the project. So it's no longer one organization owning it and making all decisions, the community itself. Mike said that developers and participants vote with their feet. If they don't like what you're doing, they'll just stop using it. Or they'll take your open source code and start building their own system, which can actually compete. It's happened before, and usually it's good for the users because users get two products to choose from. With that being said, most open source projects begin by being seeded by some sponsor. So either it's a company donating code, or it's a government organization providing the foundation and resources to get it started, or it's actually some nonprofit group that comes together with a common goal in mind and commits some resources to building software and sharing that with whatever its user community is. Even though it's seeded by an organization, it is immediately self-selecting. So once sort of the key principles are started and once the infrastructure is set in place, you have people literally coming out of the woodwork, serendipitous users and committers who can come and identify their needs and their changes they want to make and suggest those to the group. And so what ends up happening is that each project determines what development methodology it wants to use and how it affects its rules of behavior and how it wants to operate. So here's an example of a typical community structure. So there's, you know, as many different structures out there as there are people in this room. This is one that a few projects have used. It's not anyone in particular, but I just wanted to give an example so I'm not talking all nebulous. So it starts out with a steering committee. So at the top, there's going to be some group that decides what they want to do, what their vision is, what needs they need to meet. And that steering committee forms a group of project management committees. And so a steering committee is the overall portfolio or set of projects it's going to work with. And the project management committee is just one little piece of software, one project it's working on. Within that project, there are committers who actually are allowed to change code. So open source, everyone can see code, but only trusted individuals can change code. And not just changing code, but suggesting code, any user can go and view the source code, find an idea, suggest and contribute that change, which then gets reviewed by the trusted committers and either rejected or incorporated or built into the system. And then, of course, there's the users. And a user doesn't just mean someone running software. It's someone contributing requirements and shaping direction and interested in the project itself. So you see the little avatars here, the icons, and those things on top of them are hats. So one person doesn't have one role. You can wear many hats. So you can be on the steering committee, you can also be a user. You can be a contributor, you can also be a project manager. The idea here is it's not one person is slotted into one role, but you can actually be a participant in many different facets of a project's lifecycle. And that's usually what happens is people will move up from user to contributor to committer all the way up. Key to this community is a collaboration portal. So since not everyone's going to be meeting in a room, people are all over the world, all over the United States, all over your partner locations. You need a virtual workspace or meeting room, which is going to allow people to post messages, view messages, search content, find out what's going on. There's quite a few platforms out there. One of the popular ones this graphic is showing is a product called GeForge. GeForge is used by NIH's CA Big project, and it's basically a hosted solution which gives you collaboration, source control output, access to the actual source code and what changes are going on, and it also has some security built in to prove if you have access to make changes that only you can make changes, not just any Yahoo off the internet. But there's also other pieces out there. There's SharePoint, there's Plone, which is another open source piece, and really there's so many out there. A lot of time agencies will build their own or roll their own version depending on what their needs are. But the key is that you have access for stakeholders. And the public actually might be that stakeholder. And in most open source projects, the public is that key stakeholder. So it's the way that they go and they submit their changes. They track the status of that change to see if someone's working on it or maybe they should be working on it. But it's the hub for the community that stores all content, all exchanges, and all communication. So you have that transparency, discoverability, and communication. There's a few legal and policy issues with open source, and when I say a few, it's an enormous understatement. So you could have a week-long seminar going into legal issues and policy issues around open source, but I'm just going to highlight a few here. So the idea is that each community or each sponsor organization selects which license they have. So Mike mentioned non-viral licenses, and he mentioned viral licenses. In the federal government, what usually happens is they take one of these licenses and adopt it based on their requirements. So going back to what NIH did, they actually took a non-viral license like BSD, and they added in their layers of legal non-warranty and legal releases and reuse and FOA clauses and so forth, and they built their own license. It's still an open source license, but it was unique to their community because they had specific requirements that no other license out there met. This really determines what kind of support you can have, whether you can have third-party partnership who can contribute, because if some other project is using a conflicting license, then you're going to have different ways of interacting with them if they're using a compatible license. And it really sort of marks what side of the license hill or a wall that your community sits on. Governance. So governance is key to any project, and open source is a totally different experience because you no longer have one person paying and choosing and deciding and picking which requirements they want. The community itself is picking that. So it's a difference of controlling versus guiding. And there's sort of strong guidance in the way resources are assigned. So in open source projects, participation is voluntary, but of course funding helps. So in a lot of projects, you'll see companies or agencies pay for resources. It might be a project manager, it might be a developer, it might be a tester, it might be a focus group coordinator. But the idea is that there's still somebody out there volunteering their time, volunteering their funding, their resources. So the government's community actually guides the government's actually guides the community towards what they want. But it could end up that if somebody else had a suggestion and want to implement it, they could contribute that into the project. So instead of the traditional duties of governance cycle, in an open source project, that group establishes vision, creates new projects, changes projects, gets rid of projects when they're transitioned away. It picks what kind of development model, what kind of licensing model. So how changes get made to the project and how those changes are released out is what governance does. It picks which requirements you're going to move forward. So it identifies requirements for the community. And it also governs assets. So if somebody's paying for a communication hub, a communication portal, it's sitting on a server somewhere, and governance is responsible for getting that server running, making sure it's available, making sure users connect. And also it acts as a partnership liaison with other projects. So in the software world, and actually in the normal world as well, projects are interconnected. So you have dependencies. In order for project one to succeed, project two has to be ready and succeeding as well. So governance actually works as the communications line or the interconnectivity between those projects to make sure that what your project is developing works well with the dependencies it's created with partners. And really, you always have trust with your governance, but it's a different trust when someone can fire you than when someone can just use your software. And so the idea is the community needs to learn to trust the governance and trust the project management council, because really, developers and users really do vote with their feet. So they can either continue on with the project or they can find something else. Again, there's also sort of organizational composition. So who participates in governance? Since it's open source, everyone can view minutes and everyone can see what's going on, but only committee members, only ones who are seated or voted on by the community, can actually vote. And so the idea is you don't want to have a free-for-all forum with 1,000 people screaming. You want a few people screaming and everyone else seeing what they were yelling about. And the idea is it's initially established by a founding organization, whoever contributed the project, but that committee then picks new members as they change. So no one lives forever. The idea is once people move on, they select who the next members are. I mentioned about being liaison to other partners. So if you're the Linux operating system, you might want to work with application servers. Or if you're a database, you might want to work with an application server. And so the idea is those leadership groups are responsible for interoperability. So if you have key requirements for working with another project or working with another group, it's governance that really sets that out and gives that to the community and determines which are essential and what direction they should move. So it's interoperability in the sense of syntactic interoperability of, you know, are we speaking the same language or are we speaking the same format, but specifically semantic. So you have to be able to understand the specific data coming out of your applications and going in. And so governance is responsible for controlling that both of those take place. And then also governance kind of watches and monitors to make sure that those changes are coming along at the right pace, might nudge the community in certain ways and necessary. And it also establishes change control procedures. So when any project, you're going to have ways of how contributions are proposed, how they're submitted to the community, how they're reviewed for quality, security, et cetera, and then finally how they make it in the project or actually don't make it in the project. So here's one change control process. It's pretty simple. It's taken from an existing open source project. I don't remember which one, but the idea is you have different roles who go through this life cycle. So first, some user comes in and suggests a change. I want a new button. I need a new code supported. Then someone either takes that and writes some code and sends it in the community and says, here's what I want you to implement. It's then reviewed by the project management committee to say, do we need this change? Is it time? Is it in the release cycle? And then some committer out there within the community takes that change, tests it, makes sure it's okay, makes sure it fits in, makes sure nothing breaks, makes sure there's no security vulnerabilities. And then they actually commit it into the project and they add it in, and the next time someone downloads it or installs it, that feature is there. So again, this isn't the process, it's just one. There are tons of little variations, and of course any five-step process is never complete. So that's, you know, one example of many. I'm going to hand it back to Mike so we can go over the specific CDC open source policy and then also wrap up with some of the conclusions. Thanks, Brian.
And the reason we're talking about the CDC open source policy is just one case. I mean, if you get into working with open source, either you want to purchase open source from outside and bring it into your environment, or you want to produce your own open source software, you're going to run into a situation where you need to find out whether your particular environment actually allows open source or not. In CDC's case, for a long time, it did not. And, you know, so the security folks, you know, their tendency is not to want things to change because they're about security. So if they got kind of a wrapper around what's there, they don't want you bringing something new in. So their tendency was to, you know, let's not rock the boat here. The infrastructure folks, they're the same way. They want things to basically stay the same. They've got people who support what's there. Yeah, if people are bringing in new stuff, then, you know, they have to bring in the skills to support that. So the group that was left with making sure that the business needs were met was the enterprise architecture group. So, and you may see this in your own organization, where, you know, the infrastructure folks are, you know, they basically want stability and keep things the same. And there's validity to that. There's a reason for that. And the same thing with security folks, and they're about security, so they want things to be locked down and secure. Yes. Okay, one more minute. We'll get through this. so there's a lot of business-based justifications for open source. I mean, a lot of it has to do with cost and innovation. So working with the folks in infrastructure and security and the CIO, the Chief Information Officer at CDC, we worked to get a policy in place that addressed all of their needs, plus the business need to be able to bring open source into the environment. And we had to jump through a bunch of hoops to do that, and it took about a year. But one of the main things we found out is if the CIO is on board, that goes a long way toward getting this done. And getting the CIO on board, in our case, had to do with the fact that he was very interested in saving money. He was also very interested in innovation. So he's getting hit about the head and shoulders from the people above him about cutting costs and innovating. And while open source can lead to a lot of that. And so once he was convinced of that, then he was pretty much on our side. So working with the infrastructure folks and the security folks, we wordsmithed it to the point where we were able to get them to sign off on it, get the Chief Information Officer to sign off on it, and then send it to the folks who actually went through all the reviews to get it put in place as a formal policy. So now CDC has a formal policy that's been in place for about a year now, which actually allows people to go out and select an open source software as opposed to just commercial software or government off-the-shelf software. So, and basically the policy boiled down to, you know, you don't want to treat open source any differently than commercial off-the-shelf or government off-the-shelf or software that's developed in-house. So yes, it still has to comply with everything that those pieces of software comply with in terms of security and supportability and all that stuff, but there are no extra boundaries or barriers put in place to being able to select open source. So that's really what that boiled down to. So to conclude, I mean, everything we've talked about, if you wanted to do a successful open source project, you need a trusted project governance that understands the goals and vision of the organization, a strong, active community that's able to carry out that vision, some tools that'll facilitate active communication and collaboration amongst those that community, and then appropriate licensing that will allow participation in the community and use of the software by stakeholders in an appropriate way, or a way that's appropriate to your organization. And successful open source policies require collaboratively developed rules and regulations, up-to-date, accessible catalog of approved for use open source projects and products so that it's very visible and transparent, and executive and line management buy-in and awareness and support. So I talked about how we got our CIO on board. That's very important. And, you know, software, when we talk about open source, I mean, it's just, typically all these things are come together and are combined. So if you look at CA Big, I mean, they're, a lot of their work is based on open source software that they purchased and brought in. They're actually developing open source code using those tools, and they've got a license that they've actually built for themselves for that code that they're developing. So a lot of these things, and they're using it in collaborative, the open source methodology for collaborative development. And so that's the other thing, is that the actual methodology for developing open source software is, has been very successful because it is collaborative. So all those things kind of very often come together. They don't have to be, you know, all together at the same time, but typically you do see them. We've got some references here for you. So our actual policy, we've got a URL there. The Flashline Pattern Book for open source we found to be very useful because it was it had a lot of information in there about how to sell open source to the to your management. So what are the selling points for open source? And it actually had a lot of templates and slideshows and a lot of good wording and studies that have been done on open source to show that it is high quality and high security and on and on. The seminal work, The Cathedral and the Bazaar by Eric Stephen Raymond, which came out in the late 90s, really is a very good description of this open source methodology for collaborative development. So he takes a look at how the Linux project was done and says why, and breaks it down into why it was so successful. And we've got some other sources there, and you can see those in the slides. So we'll leave questions to the end.